From the City of Angels off the Pacific Ocean, good morning, good evening, wherever you may be across the nation, around the world. I'm George Norrie. Welcome to Coast AM. Next hour, Secret Societies with Jim Mars. We're also going to talk a little bit about the Nazi Bell, an incredible story. Email just in from Chuck and Rogue. Says, George, been listening to Coast, and I've been hearing about the possible Bigfoot capture made in Georgia. When my friend and I saw the pictures, we felt that these people are trying to deceive everyone. The creature looks like a mannequin. The Patterson footage looked more authentic. We shall see. Yes, we shall see. As a matter of fact, tomorrow is the news conference when they are supposed to announce some DNA results and also let some researchers poke and prod this creature that has been frozen in a refrigerator, a freezer, and Lauren Coleman will be there, and we will get a full report on our first hour tomorrow night on Coast to Coast AM. We'll just have to wait and see. German researchers trying to slow melting glaciers have set up a large screen in the Swiss Alps that they hope will trap cold air over the icy mass. The structure is 49 feet by 10 feet. It was raised right in the middle of the Rhone Glacier in Switzerland's southwestern region by 27 students from a university in Germany. Again, the purpose of the screen, which sits at an altitude of about 7,000 feet, is to keep cold winds over the glacier. Kind of a novel idea there. Global warming, somewhat controversial, right? Evolution, even more so. But there's still one founded scientific notion that everyone can agree on, right? It's called the Earth is round, like a ball, almost an egg. Well, maybe not. The BBC continues to report that the Flat Earth Society, thought to have been crippled by the death of its leader in 2001, is still hanging on. People are definitely prejudiced against flat earthers, said the Tennessee-based computer scientist and society member John Davis. And the Earth is more or less a disc, states James McIntyre, a Brit who helps run the Flat Earth Society's website. He says, now, obviously, it isn't perfectly flat, thanks to the geological phenomena like hills and valleys, but it is around 24,900 miles in diameter. I want to get them on the program in the not-too-distant future to talk about why they continue to believe that Earth is flat. High hopes plummeting into fearful confusion now in key Georgian cities as Russian troops appeared ready to pull out. Then they returned. Georgia's government said Russian tanks and other vehicles advanced toward the country's second largest city, but later stopped dozens of miles away. Ryan Murrow was hired at the age of 16 as the youngest geopolitical analyst in the country. Then around the fall of 2003, Ryan joined the Northeast Intelligence Network, Doug Hagman's group. Since then, he's been published in WorldNet Daily, Newsmax.com. He's been on Coast to Coast before. Hey, Ryan, how are you?
Good. Thanks for having me.
Good. What is your assessment on this situation? I mean, we hear there's a ceasefire. We hear the Russian troops are pulling out. Now we hear they're moving back in. What's going on there, Ryan?
What Russia is preparing to do is they're creating defensive lines around the two separatist provinces of Georgia, Abkhazia and South Ossetia, where there's the ethnic Russian population. The reason they're doing that is that they can say, look, we withdrew from the sovereign Georgian territory, but we don't consider these two provinces to be Georgian territory. Let us have them because you can't do anything about it. Basically, what Russia is doing is they're testing to see if Hitler's strategy still works. A lot of people forget that Hitler justified his invasion of the Sudetenland by saying there was an ethnic German population there that wanted independence, and it was his country's duty to give it to them. That's the same justification that Russia used to invade Georgia, and depending on our next moves, it will be tried again in the Ukraine.
Is it a surprise to you, Ryan, that the United States doesn't seem to be doing anything forcefully to stop the Russians?
Not really, because there's not much that we can do. We've canceled the NATO-Russian summit, some joint NATO-Russian exercises, but beyond that, there isn't much we can do, especially considering that Russian forces are so close to that critical oil pipeline in Georgia now. So Russia benefits from these high oil prices. A lot of people think of the Middle East, but Russia benefits just as much, and now Russia is going to have access to another giant oil pipeline. Financially speaking and strategically, this is a great victory for Russia. And if it results in Georgia not becoming part of NATO because the West doesn't want to confront Russia, it will be repeated in the Ukraine, where there's another ethnic Russian population that the Russians can say, oh, they want independence? We're going to make sure they get it, and they'll go in.
And, Ryan, today Poland and the United States agreed on a missile defense pact. That, too, could be a problem down the line, don't you think?
It could be a problem. I think what really scares the Russians is the fact that the U.S. and Eastern Europe are growing closer as a whole. I mean, the missile defense system is a defensive military system. If the Russians aren't planning on nuking anyone, they shouldn't have to worry about it. But unfortunately, the Russian state of mind, you have to remember that Putin publicly said he regretted the collapse of the Soviet Union, saying it was the biggest mistake of the past century, I believe he said. So in his mind, anything that strengthens the United States threatens Russia. And that's the mindset that we're dealing with now. Unfortunately, it took this long for us to realize it because the first like 5 or 6 years of the Bush administration's terms, they said that, you know, Putin was a friend and that he looked into his eyes and saw his soul and that he was a good man. True experts wouldn't have said that.
Well, it kind of seems like the old Soviet Union was a little like Humpty Dumpty, Ryan, and now they're trying to put it back together again. Ryan's website, worldthreats.com. Thank you, Ryan, for being on the program. A federal appeals court has ruled that Saudi Arabia and four of its princes cannot be held liable in the 9/11 attacks, even if they were aware that charitable donations to Muslim groups would be funneled to Al-Qaeda. The Second U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals said the defendants were protected by sovereign immunity and that the plaintiffs would need to prove that the princes engaged in intentional actions aimed at U.S. residents. Problems for Pakistan President Musharraf. Faced with desertions by his political supporters and the neutrality of the Pakistani military, it looks like the important ally of the United States, Musharraf, is expected to resign, they say, in the next few days, rather than face impeachment charges. Isn't that interesting, though, that in a time of when confidence is lost in public leaders in every area except ours, they just simply resign and new elections are held and off they go into Never Never Land. Federal regulators announced $7.1 million in fines against American Airlines over the maintenance issues and problems with its drug and alcohol testing programs. Nearly $4.5 million of the proposed fines stem from America's continued operation, they say, of two MD-83 jetliners in December 2007 after pilots had reported problems with the autopilot systems. One of those aircraft flew more than 50 times before the problems were properly diagnosed. Even after that, they were improperly repaired. You know, that incident involving Senator Barack Obama's campaign plane last month was much more serious than the airline or the Federal Aviation Administration said, according to FAA control tapes obtained by ABC News. At the time, an FAA spokesperson said the pilot did not declare an emergency, and that the airline owner, Midwest Airlines, said safety was never an issue. Here's an excerpt of that tape.
We have a controllability issue with this aircraft. We have limited pitch authority at flight levels. We're descending to see if we can regain pitch authority, and we're going to have to stop probably around 8,000 to 10,000 feet to configure the aircraft to make sure that we have control authority. And St. Louis Approach Medics 8663, at this time we'd like to declare this an emergency and also have CFR standing by in St. Louis.
Medics 8663, all right. I will show that. And would you do you have a preference on runways? Would you like runway 30 right or runway 30 left?
Well, which one is the longest?
Medics 8663, runway 30 left.
Okay, we'd like 30 left. And just for informational purposes, we have Senator Obama on board the aircraft in his campaign.
Yeah, that's a good idea. Take the longer runway. The FAA spokesperson has acknowledged that its statements at the time of no emergency were wrong, I guess so, based on erroneous reports from FAA air traffic managers. Batman star Christian Bale will not face charges over an alleged assault on his mother and sister The actor was arrested in London last month and questioned over claims that he lashed out at his family members while staying at a hotel there. He was in the United Kingdom to promote The Dark Knight. He denied the charges at the time. A former part-time Pennsylvania police officer has been sentenced to 30 days in jail for pulling over a woman while he was off duty just to give her his phone number. Police said he used his red and blue lights mounted on the dashboard of his pickup truck to pull over a woman in eastern Pennsylvania in April of last year. The woman became suspicious when he began to ask her if she was married or had a boyfriend. Coast2coastamp.com hot stories. Rat brain cells tell robots where to go. This is an amazing story. Researchers in England have built a small robot that's controlled by a petri dish full of rat neurons, which remotely steers the robot via Bluetooth wireless signals. To build the cyborg, the researchers dissolved a fetal rat's brain. They then put the free-floating brain cells or neurons into an electrode-ringed petri dish where the cells quickly reassociated with each other and began randomly firing electrical signals. What an amazing story. By the way, where have all the sunspots gone? We're supposed to have a lot of them, and we don't. What does this all mean? In a moment, Professor James McKenney, he's next on Coast to Coast AM. Now, here he is. He's one of my heroes, Professor James McKenney. He taught computer science and astronomy as well as numerous other math classes. He has a weekly radio show called the James McKenney Science Hour. And here he is on Coast to Coast AM. Jim, how are you?
George, hello.
Good
evening.
Always a pleasure. Jimmy, where are all the sunspots?
We could write a song. Where have all the sunspots gone?
Not really? Really?
But they're not there. On the far side?
It's
on the
weird.
Side. Yes.
Isn't this supposed to be the time where we get a lot of sunspots?
Well, they should be starting, and apparently there have been about 400 days consistently that we have not seen many at all. There have been a few, but certainly not the numbers that we should be seeing in a normal solar cycle.
Now, how long have we been recording the sunspots? I know spaceweather.com has a numerical count on sunspots, and you know, during this season they say zero. Has this been going on for years where we monitor sunspot activity?
Oh, it's been one of the longest term solar observations, first observed by Galileo when he looked at the sun. And in fact, that's why Galileo went blind in his latter years, because he had been observing the sun with his telescope.
Oh, without any filter, probably.
Right. And, of course, we've learned since that you don't do that. But so it is one of the longest-term solar observations around.
Now, James, you know, based on science, the fact that there are no sunspots on the sun, and there haven't been for a long time, what does that tell you? I mean, what does that tell you about the sun? Is it cooling? What's happening?
Well, traditionally, it would indicate cooling, and that's the majority opinion that I've been seeing. I was just at the American Geophysical Union meeting in May, and I was in a group with basically all military, Air Force, and dealing with many of these issues, solar issues, primarily solar issues. And I talked with a Russian scientist there, and they are modeling the next solar cycle, and what they're saying is it should be fairly weak based on sunspot activity, and they have a number of other factors that they measure and then use as predictive parameters.
Jim, if the sun is cooling, does it mean it's dying?
Well, it's very difficult to predict, because the sun, what I've learned is the sun reacts to its environment. It's not just in control of its own future, so
right,
to speak. So there's definitely some things could happen. In fact, I definitely observed that hail bop was a factor that increased the last solar cycle. So we might be seeing a whiplash effect, so to speak, in the cycling of the sun as it overheated, so to speak, in the early 2000s, and then now it's going the opposite direction. So we're seeing maybe a cyclic reaction of the sun, but it's very hard to predict.
Do coronal mass ejections come out of the sun spots or just out of the sun in general?
Well, just out of the sun in general. The sunspot numbers are related to magnetic activity, and many times you have big sunspots with no activity. Sometimes they're related, and that's one of the ongoing study areas of many scientists trying to relate. But there's many times when we have sunspots and absolutely no solar activity, no solar coronal mass ejections or other flaring activity. So it's they can be related, but not always. So that's one of the mysteries of the sun.
Are you concerned at all, James, because there's been a lack of sunspot activity?
Well, the actual temperatures that people are quoting now relate to a decrease in temperature. And, of course, there's so much hype about global warming.
Yeah. And the solar system seems to be heating up, though. That's strange, isn't it?
Well, planets such as Mars. Now, you have to understand, too, Mars is gaining atmosphere. And so that would be another reason for it to gain temperature, because it can hold more heat. And so you have to look at all of these factors. Earth is a very complex system, because we have regions where it's very dry and the heat can be released very rapidly. And then we have the tropic regions, which are typically humid, and they can retain a lot of heat. So there's and plus we have all the oceans. It's an extremely complex system. And my opinion is we have far too little data. And I criticize scientists a lot of time for just sticking the thermometer out the window and saying this is global warming, when temperature many times has nothing to do with actual heat content.
I thought of you when I saw the story this week about Venus, where they were hypothesizing, Jim, that some microbial life could jump on some kind of solar wind coming off of Venus clouds and could hit Earth.
Well, since the Chinese started observing they call it the swine flu, it's actually related to the cycles of Venus. And actually, this is in the medical journals also, well documented. And there's a lot of this information online, so you can actually look at the data. And actually, as long as we're talking about sunspots, the sunspot activity increases as Venus and Earth align with the sun. There's always a little, somewhat of a spike in sunspot activity. But the viral activity causing the swine flu, which then turns into bird flu, which can transmutate into human flu, has been associated with Venus since the 1200s.
Any comets coming our way, Jim?
Not that I'm aware of right now. Nothing that we have to hide from at this point. But there again, those things can come in without announcement and very much affect the sun. And I think solar physicists have to understand that the sun is affected by its environment, and this could all turn around overnight, especially if we did have a big comet and it started affecting the sun.
Hey, Jim, what are your current projects you've been working on?
Well, I just had a very odd, interesting one. Due to the flooding in the Midwest this year, I had a project where I went out and located some of the last remaining corn seed that was the original corn seed, the kind you would have had in the 1940s on the family farm, and found that there was extremely small amount of this. So I bought it all, and I've been distributing this worldwide.
Really?
To regenerate the original corn population and get that biodiversity out there.
Without the GM, the genetically modified corn.
Absolutely.
Good idea.
Without GM, this has all been organically raised, and we're about probably halfway through that project. But it's
That's great.
I was amazed at the response when I actually announced this.
You're sort of like a Johnny Appleseed, but we're going to call you Jimmy Cornseed. Stay with us. Professor James McCanney with us this hour. We're going to take your phone calls. The numbers are coming up. Next hour, Jim Mars joins us. We talk about secret societies, but when we come right back, it's you and Professor James McCanney right here on Coast to Coast AM. Jim, do you hear anything more about Velikovsky's theories? I mean, some scientists are beginning to think maybe he was right.
Well, as I said, I was just at a meeting, and it was very interesting, the reactions. I've been going to these for decades. And my poster, one of the presentations there that I gave, was very well received. And like I said before, I was with the one of the military groups from the Air Force, and these people are realists. So they deal with reality. They're not worried about personalities. Most of the time, you never hear these people's names, and they rarely are seen in the limelight. But they deal with reality. They want to know what's really going on, and they very much agree with what I'm doing. Just a little example, that hurricanes are not created by warm water. One of the things I've been saying for a long time, and they're definitely driven by electrical influences from outside the planet. So these ideas are very much taking hold, and then the overall concept that the solar system is electrically charged due to the solar wind, and all of these effects down to our own auroras, our Earth electrical current system that is driving the weather systems, the troposphere, all of this is really coming into vogue, you might say.
Absolutely. To the phones we go. Let's go to Blair in Arizona, west of the Rockies. Blair, go ahead.
Hi, thanks, George. Dr. McCanney, do you have an opinion about the variable star theory that's posited by Dr. J.J. Hertak? He's the author of The Keys of Enoch, whereby our sun is sort of reacting to the current energy field in this geographical position of its galactic orbit right now?
You know, also, as we note on here that I have a master's degree.
Yeah, so it's not doctor, but professor it is.
That I'm actually not real familiar with that, so I'll just have to say that I'm not familiar with that concept. But we interact with the galaxy in much the same way that, say, comets interact with the solar wind, or Earth interacts with the solar wind, in that there is a galactic wind of charged particles, and the sun and the solar system move through that. So we do interact with that, but we're very distant from any other active stars. So we're somewhat on our own out here. We're in the far suburbs, you might say, of the galaxy.
Next up, Marion in Missouri, east of the Rockies. Hey, Marion.
Hello, George and Professor. I have a question I've been wondering about for some time. In an astronomy course I took years ago at the planetarium here, they were talking about neutrinos, and they said that if the emission rate of neutrinos increases, the star is probably dying. Has our sun's emission rate increased any dramatically over the years?
Neutrino measurement is very difficult, and depending on the technique, there's actually, when you get down into the depths of the world of physics, there's a lot of disagreement on the real neutrino rate and the sources of neutrinos, etc. So whether it's changing or not would depend on who's measuring. And I'm not aware of anybody that's saying, for example, our sun is in danger of fading or whatever due to neutrino change in neutrino activity.
Jim, in Egyptian myth, Apophis was the ancient spirit of evil and destruction, a demon that was determined to plunge the world into eternal darkness. On 2029 and then 2036, asteroid Apophis gets close to the planet. Are you watching that at all? Are you following up on that situation?
Well, the situation with asteroids like that is one, first of all, of measurement, and then also of predictive capabilities of computer systems. And so until they get very close, actually, it's very difficult to make predictions. So as time approaches, in fact, until you're almost about a month out, it's very difficult to predict.
Too close for comfort, though, Jim.
But yes, and there are gravitational effects. Just imagine that something small the size of, the room you're in would hit this asteroid. Within that 10 or 20-year period, the effect accumulated over that time would be enough to send this object to a far different orbit. So many things can happen between now and then. And just the measurements, the measurements have to be so exact to predict that far out, and then the computer calculation. So it's there again, as I said, within the if we're going to start, say we were going to start affecting asteroid orbits so they wouldn't hit Earth, you would be hard-pressed to do something at this point intelligently, because you might push it in the wrong direction and it wouldn't end up hitting Earth where it wouldn't have if you just left it alone.
Let's teleport to Phoenix, first-time caller line. Hey, Rick, you're up with us.
Hi, and good evening to both of you.
Sure.
I got a kind of a two-parter in a way. First, I'd like to make a comment. Just by chance, I was sitting along the side of the road waiting for somebody else. I was in my car, and I looked up, and the sun was in the clouds. It was the first time ever that I could actually see the sun, the outline of the sun. What I'm trying to refer to is that it seemed to be a little bit weaker than normal. Any relevance to that observation?
All right, question one, Jim.
Well, actually, the sun is probably, you know, for a measurement like that, there are people making many different types of measurements now relative to the sun, and they're starting to measure on a consistent basis in all of the various parts of the electromagnetic spectrum. And it's very difficult, even with good instrumentation, to measure the total output, energy output of the sun. But, no, just observing through a cloud like that, you would be hard-pressed to make any determination or, you know.
Right, I understand. The second part is that, pardon me, through, I guess, a lot of things that I've heard about is that Earth changes and our axis, we're changing on our axis, and the North Pole and South Pole is interacting with one another and so on. Does that have any reference to what the sun is doing now?
Well, our magnetic field responds to some of the conditions that cause sunspots. And, in fact, one of the methods of predicting sunspots is actually by measuring our geomagnetic field and changes in it. But it's all of these things are still in the somewhat theoretical development, you might say. There are a lot of theoretical models, and scientists are getting much closer to predictive capability. But there again, these are still kind of nebular ideas, still in development, and predictions are relatively difficult to come by.
Hey, Jim, of the work you do, what truly fascinates you?
I think the fact that objects in space, no matter how big or small they are, all interact the same way with the solar system, and our sun interacts the same way in the galactic wind. There are some very basic, simple principles, and one of the most basic is an object discharging a capacitor and how that works in a plasma. So if you look at a comet, if you look at a spacecraft, they all interact in the same manner. If you have the space shuttle in low Earth orbit, the way it discharges the local capacitor is the exact same way that a comet would in the far reaches of the solar system. So I think there's complexity and there's simplicity, and there's kind of a middle road. The theoretical, I think throughout the history of physics, the simple ideas that have solidified and brought all of these measurements together, the simple ideas are the ones that really are noted as core ideas in physics. And so that's what I kind of work with, trying to solidify that. And I know I got a lot of comments this spring on my work as being central to a lot of the measurements that are going on.
On our wildcard line, Roger in London, Ontario, Canada. Hey, Roger, go ahead.
Good morning there, George. Dr. McKenney, you caught my attention.
Professor.
Oh, sorry. Right on. Professor McKenney,
yeah.
You caught my attention when you were saying that you were going to be distributing organic seeds for corn. And it caught my attention that that's probably like advantageous for like human consumption. And then I thought, well, any benefits to doing that? Like when if you were going to be using corn for, say, methane fuel?
Well, any corn, any grain could be made into biofuel, especially corn. But the whole purpose of this was to recreate the genetic diversity of the corn seed stock, the kind that farmers would save their own back in the 1930s, 40s, and back throughout history. And all of a sudden, when GMO, genetically modified organism type products, came out, the large seed companies have harbored this type of seed stock, and it really isn't available to the public anymore. So my intent was not to raise something for biofuel, but just to diversify the corn genetic seed population and get it out there again so it can grow in various climates and various growing conditions. And that's what gives you a very healthy worldwide genetic seed stock.
Sometimes your work is so good, James, people steal it from you. Is that still happening sometimes?
It's constant, but I think the people out there know and understand what's going on, and they know where the original source is. And when they see me doing things like the calculate primes, and I just released a new number system, people know that I'm on the cutting edge. I'm creating these issues, and with the comet electrical nature of the solar system, with a complete composite theory on how all of this works, that is being accepted now by the wide range scientific community. You know, they know what I'm doing, and they know who the copycats are.
Absolutely. All right, next up, Mike in Nevada, driving around west of the Rockies. Go ahead, Michael.
Hi, George and Professor McKenney.
Sure.
Big fan of yours, Professor. I hope you remember the conversation that I'm going to allude to about 2.5 years ago. I believe it was you was on with Art Bell. And just before a break, you mentioned that two of the outer planets, I believe it was Uranus and Neptune, were being deformed out of their orbits, and that the Naval Observatory was going to be looking into that. And I haven't heard an update on that, so hopefully I'm attributing it to you from about 2.5 years ago. Does that sound familiar?
Well, I remember having conversations like that, and it could have gone back
even further, right?
Even further,
yeah.
But after all the radio shows I do, it's hard to pinpoint a specific one. But definitely, yeah, the planets, and that was something that actually was being studied in the 1980s by the Naval Observatory. It was, oddly enough, under a project funded by NASA called the Search for Planet X.
Oh, okay.
And Harrington and Tom Van Flandert worked there at the time under Harrington. So that was a project that went on into the 90s. And, of course, those issues are still ongoing. We have the Voyager spacecraft, which are not where they're supposed to be, the Pioneer spacecraft that are not exactly where they're supposed to be. So all the issues of those little things that aren't quite right. There's many of those issues out there and still being studied very much by astronomers and astrophysicists. Very complicated issues when you start dealing with long-term trends, the speed of light, the speed of gravity, the speed that gravity works over distances, very complex issues.
Okay, Mike, thanks for the call. Next up, let's go to you, Tom, in Mississippi. Welcome to Coast to Coast.
Yes, I'm sure glad I finally got in touch with y'all. I've been trying since 98.
Well, I got you a couple more minutes to go, so you just made it. Go ahead, Tom.
Okay. Back about 3 years ago, we had a pretty good little fog, but you could still see the sun. And I got my binoculars out and was looking at it, and I saw three dark specks, but they were oblong. I mean, they were kind of like rectangles, and they had form, and I didn't think that that sunspots had form to them. And I was just wondering what that could have been, if it was asteroids or maybe even, you know, some spaceship up there.
But the sunspots take on many different shapes, so they're not round, so to speak. And they typically will come in pairs. So that gives you the illusion that they're square or rectangular, or and they're not always, as I said, perfectly round. Or symmetrical. So they can take on some very strange shapes as they couple with other sunspot activity in their area. So, yeah, they can take on some odd shapes, and so it wouldn't be unusual that you would see them.
Jim, any traveling for you in the future?
Well, not till the end of the summer, but I'm looking at some conferences coming up in the that I've been invited to talk at some coming up on various topics related to space, solar physics, and other applications to science. So,
let's try to squeeze in Joseph in Tallahassee, Florida. First-time caller. Go ahead, Joseph.
Yes, hi, Professor.
Hi.
Yes, I'm a student at Florida State University. We have a library named after Paul Dirac. I don't know if you've heard of the physicist Paul Dirac.
Oh, yes.
He has a theory on antimatter and the power of antimatter. I was just very confused on because they have posters and whatnot and of the different formulas that they've used to prove that antimatter exists. And I was just wondering what the whole idea behind that was.
Well, antimatter is a very well understood a property is there are many experiments that produce antimatter, and the opposite of, for example, electrons, the positrons, and you know, you go right up the subatomic food chain, so to speak, and you find the antimatter particles. So they're have been produced in the laboratory, and we know about them. It's conceivable that their entire coordinated universes that are made up of antimatter. So it's a very well-known, very well-understood part of physics.
Jim, we're out of time. Your website, of course. Would you give it to us?
The abbreviated form that'll get you there, JMCC, S as in Sam, C as in Charlie, I as in Indigo.com, JMCCSCI.com.
Very good. That's Professor James McCanny. We'll be back in a moment. Jim Mars joins us, The Rise of the Fourth Reich, Secret Societies.